Hello and welcome to The Two Dyspraxics. I'm Barbara Neal.
And I'm Matthew Munson.
So today we're going to talk about our coping strategies. And I emphasise the word our because I think we probably all have very different coping strategies. So we'll start off with one of yours, Matthew.
Oh, thanks.
You're welcome.
As you can, as our listeners can tell from that, we script this very, very tightly. Because actually, this is really interesting because, so for me, like one of my strategies is, you know, around my handwriting and yeah, to take notes, and that is do as few handwritten notes as possible. Because I always remember when I was at school, so this was, I don't know, 80s and 90s. I'm naturally left-handed. You know, it's my dominant hand, I guess you'd say. But when I was at primary school, one of my teachers made me write with my right hand.
That's terrible.
But it was so outdated. But she hated seeing someone, another couple in our class. So I was writing with my weak hand and I was dyspraxic. And so I just never bothered taking notes. I never did it because it was so hard. And I never knew how to write notes. I was like, well, what am I taking notes of? You're telling me this information. I'm either going to remember it or I'm not. I'm never going to read these notes again because I just won't. I can't read my own handwriting. So I used to just kind of wing it a little bit and use textbooks for homework and stuff. But nowadays, if I need to do notes, I'll ask for the information to be sent in a summary email to me just so I can read it at my leisure then. Yeah, but I'll be quite honest with the person talking to me. I'll say, I am not going to be taking any notes because I just find it too difficult. Please, whatever we talk about, please summarise for me. Or you write it down for me and I'll take that away.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And what you're saying about taking notes is just, oh, crikey, I just don't do it either nowadays. But when I was at school, I can remember just having to second guess what had been on the blackboard because I couldn't copy it down fast enough. So I'd be lucky if I could get half of the notes I was supposed to have. And then, of course, when homework comes around, I'd spend all evening doing it because with short-term memory problems as well, you know, you're trying to memorise things that other people have got notes for and absolute nightmare. So, yeah, I'm exactly the same. So I'll just type things wherever humanly possible. I just do as little handwriting as possible.
But I think as well, that's a good coping strategy for now, isn't it? The point didn't exist when either one of us were at school, you know, 5 minutes ago, obviously. We didn't have tablets, we didn't have laptops, we didn't have portable technology that we could use.
Exactly.
If I'd have had a laptop, I'd have been quitting. It'd have been great.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we would have been on a par with everybody else, with all of our peers. But I suspect probably when you were at school, you probably didn't even have blackboards, did you? I expect you had a whiteboard.
I remember a couple of the classrooms. I went to a Catholic school, and I can remember a couple of the classrooms, which were very old, still had the old chalkboards in. But to be fair, most of them were whiteboards.
Well, they were all blackboards when I was at school. Well, they were green, actually. I don't think we ever had any blackboards as such, but that's neither here nor there. But anyway, as far as the coping strategies are concerned, there's something that cropped up recently because I've had quite a severe case of eczema. Oh, I'm sorry about all the jingle jangle going on in the background.
But popular.
It's not that, I'm afraid. It's because I've just come from an online meeting from my job, and so the stuff is still there and it's still sort of
pinging away,
nagging me. Yeah, so no apologies for that. But something happened because I have quite severe eczema around my left eye, and I finally found something that is banishing it. It's fantastic stuff, this cream. But when I was putting the cream on, I would use my left hand because it's my left eye, you know, so it makes sense. So I'd use my left hand to apply the cream. But my right hand, I had to consciously put my right hand on my leg or on a tabletop or something like that, because I don't know if you have ever noticed this about yourself or if it affects you in any way. But when it's, you know, when people say, does the left hand know what the right hand's doing? Well, in my case, yes, it does, because it tries to emulate what your hand is doing. So that's a really weird thing. And I discovered this when I had my assessment for dyspraxia,
mm-hmm.
because I was asked to do something with one hand. And then the assessor said to me afterwards, "Did you notice what your other hand was doing?" So, no. You know, I was blissfully unaware that my other hand was also doing something sort of very similar. Yeah, so that's something I have to actively do. If I'm doing something intricate with one of my hands, then I have to actively think about what I'm doing with the other one as well, because it's going to start. I call it the claw, because it sort of goes into like this weird shape while it's trying to emulate what the other hand is doing. So that's definitely not a conscious thing.
How funny.
And evidently it is a sign of dyspraxia, so I don't know how many other dyspraxic people are aware of that.
That's it, because I must admit I can remember you mentioning that before, that you do it, and I meant to kind of try and watch myself and see if I do it. I'm not aware that I do it, but that's because I'm not probably watching. I know that when I had my dyspraxia assessment, and you saying that reminded me, where it was kind of like, you know, one of the tests was you balance on one foot, and which was fun. But again, my assessor said to me afterwards, she said, "Did you realise that when you go on one foot, so when you raise a leg in the air to balance on one foot, that the hand on like the side of your body that where the leg's up, you put into your pocket to try and like counterweight yourself, and it's like you're pressing down slightly to kind of put some extra pressure on that side to keep yourself balanced." And she said, "I made you do it about 5 or 6 times on each side just to see if it was a running theme," and it was. I was like, I didn't realise I did that. So I'm conscious I do it, even if I'm standing up for too long, and I struggle with kind of like standing up and just being balanced. And I find myself I put both hands in my pocket to keep myself kind of like in a good posture to stop myself from just getting a bit confused.
That's interesting, actually, because what you're doing is a kind of unconscious coping strategy if you're doing it without being aware of it.
Yeah.
Whereas what I'm doing, you know, to counteract that claw thing, that claw hand thing, that's I'm having to come up with a coping strategy to counter an unconscious action. It's almost like the other end of the scale, isn't it? That's interesting.
That's bizarre that we sometimes have these unconscious things, either strategies or things that come up because of our dyspraxia, that it needs somebody else to tell us what it is that we're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you and I have both discovered in the past about our love of handrails. not in a geeky way where we collect handrails or anything, I should say to our listeners.
In a necessary way.
Well, yeah, fair point. But I think we've said this before, but I can always remember one occasion when you and I were together and we were walking down the flight of steps, and we walked down the flight of steps, stopped, and we stopped talking as we went down the steps, and we continued our conversation exactly where we left off when we were at the bottom.
Yeah.
Because we were concentrating on our footsteps, on the movement, on making sure we weren't tripping. I think that was some occasion where I took the handrail and you had to manage.
Without.
I didn't realise I did it at the time.
Yeah, I do remember that vividly. But I mean, that's obviously because, I mean, of course, if there's a handrail there to use, then I'll use it every time, because I have to focus on the steps to prevent myself from falling over. I just have to focus on them. But that was, I think I may have mentioned this before once or twice, actually, but that's another coping strategy I developed way before I even knew about dyspraxia. And I used to put it down to being some kind of weird superstition of mine, count steps. So inwardly, you know, I don't necessarily have to count out loud, you know, because that would attract some attention, I'm sure. But in my head, I count the steps. But it doesn't matter. I don't have to start at number one. I could start at number 30 if I wanted. It doesn't matter. It's just that by counting the steps, I'm focusing on each step and keeping my attention on each step so I can get either up or down safely.
Okay. I mean, it could be, you could be going through the alphabet in your head. It could be anything, couldn't it? But for you, it's numbers.
Yeah.
I think that just, it shows the complexity of the brain that sometimes we're able to come up with strategies even without realizing it, to just help us. And I think sometimes we don't give people credit for just working something out on a subconscious level sometimes.
Yeah. It's very interesting. I'd love to hear about other people's coping strategies who have dyspraxia.
Yes.
I think it'd be very interesting to hear what other people deal with. And there's another one that springs to mind, actually. I mean, the thing about navigating a room, especially a room full of furniture, like a classroom with desks all over the place.
Yeah, and when a room changes.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's and as soon as you said that, my thought was, oh God, only if it's in the static place. You know, if something in my front room or somewhere changes, I have to really kind of look at it and go, right, change my mental map. And it takes me a while to do it. I have to really think about it.
Yeah.
It's hard.
It is hard. And when you talk about something changing, it does immediately bring back memory from many years ago when where we used to live, we had a kind of carport with metal gates, and I used to park my car. I had an old Mini at the time. That was not that long after I passed my test. But I used to get home from work, I'd open the metal gates, and then I knew I shunted once, twice, and then I could go back, I could reverse into the parking space. And that's what I did every single day. So it was something I got into the habit of. And there was this one particular day when I got home, and before I'd parked the car, my next door neighbour was there and she started talking to me. So I opened the window and I was chatting away with her. Completely forgotten. I hadn't sort of done this double shunt thing and drove backwards, pulled one of the gates off its hinges and bent the bumper of my car to right.
Oh, no.
But that, it just goes to show, because if I'm in a habit of doing something, then it's absolutely fine. But if something deviates from that, then it can have quite devastating consequences. Though, in fairness, I don't know if that's necessarily just a dyspraxia trait. So it's probably something that affects anyone, I should think.
I mean, you do hear stories about people saying that they drove somewhere or they've walked somewhere, and I've done it, and then you suddenly stop and you think, how did I get here? I don't remember that last 20-minute journey.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously I don't drive, but I can remember sometimes that I've just been, I've not been, I mean, I'll often listen to music or a podcast or something, and sometimes I'll come to, as it were, and I'm at the shop or I'm at home, I'm thinking, what just happened?
Where
did that come from? You know, I don't do that as much at the moment because I'm always tuned in, because usually I've got my son with me and he's, mm-hmm. you know, keeping me occupied so much that, of course, I'm more in the conscious zone. Yeah. But yeah, it's weird that our minds do that. And I think sometimes, I think for dyspraxics, because our memories aren't always as great, we sometimes rely on that automatic sense that humans have got, more so because our short-term memories are so poor.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. It's I refer to it as autopilot because that's pretty much what it is. But I've certainly done that, you know, with driving and walking somewhere.
Mm.
I mean, it's interesting also because as far as the driving is concerned, there are certain things that I have to, you know, I'm always alert to what's going on around me, kind of. But, I mean, yeah, I've never touched wood. I've never had any points or endorsements on my license. I've been driving since 1980. I passed my driving test in 1980. So,
wow.
But it means that if something has to go, because with dyspraxia, very much you have to, you can only focus on a certain number of things at once. But if something has to go, then it's the route.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That doesn't really matter. But if I have to be aware that, you know, somebody's cutting me up or, you know, something like that, or something that would avoid or prevent an accident, then that's fine. That always seems to be sharp enough. But But yeah, it is interesting that that kicks in, if you like, you know, if I'm not daydreaming. It's not daydreaming, is it? Hard to describe, really, this autopilot thing.
But I think it can be very useful for dyspraxic, because if you've got that route down, you know, I mean, I have to do a route several times if I can actually commit it to memory. Once you've got it, you know, it can be very, very useful. Also, just to say as well, you got your driving license in 1980. You got your driving license a year before I was born, Barbara.
You were going to say that.
you've been driving for 41 years, and I'm only 40. just thought I'd mention that.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. You know, it's an absolute pleasure to be the butt of one of your comments.
I like to think I'm a good friend, Barbara. I like to think that.
Yeah, well, I'm just very good at making allowances. I think. Oh, dearie. But anyway, as I was saying you know, when you're navigating a room that has a lot of furniture in it, and this is a flipping nightmare for me, it really is. But the way I cope with that is I'll just trail my hand along surfaces, like if there are desks and chairs and things, I trail my hand along them, and that seems to help.
I was genuinely, I promise you this is true, I was going to say that to you, that I do that, that I would always try my hand along surfaces in a new place or sometimes in a place I've been a few times, but not for a while. I'm tactile, I'll touch things, I'll move my hand along, just because it somehow helps me map up the layout of the room in my head. Yeah, it seems to lay down that mental map.
Yes. Yeah. So that would be very interesting to know if other people do the same thing. So it's just you and me. I suspect it probably isn't just you and me.
No, but it would be interesting as well to see if any like non-dyspraxics do it, or whether it is very much more so a dyspraxic trait, something that we do. I suspect it probably is.
It probably is. And I don't know if you're the same as me as well, if you go somewhere new in particular, because I still do that, even if I'm in familiar circumstances, if there's a lot of furniture or, you know, a lot of obstacles particularly. But if I go somewhere new, and like going to a pub or a restaurant, for example, you need to go to the loo. It's a nightmare, because not only do you have to navigate your way around, you know, somewhere you haven't been before particularly, or only maybe been to a couple of times or whatever, but you need to go to the loo. So you have to not only find your way there, but you have to navigate all these obstacles to get there, because there's usually lots of tables and chairs in restaurants and pubs.
Yeah.
And then remember how to get back. I can get lost in the toilets. I've even done that. I did it yesterday, actually.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, because we went to the cinema yesterday, first time for a very long time.
Oh, yeah.
And the cinema is our local cinema in Maidstone, actually. It's all been done up, so it's all very posh now compared with what it was like before. I mean, it wasn't a flea pit or anything like that, you know, but it's very smart now. And so I don't know if the layout of the toilets is the same or not. I can't remember, basically. But there's a kind of, when you go into toilets, very often there's a kind of like twisty, turny bit, you know, straight into where the toilets are. So there was the twisty, turny bit, and then there was another sort of rounder corner bit where the wash basins were, and then another sort of turny bit to where the loos were. And when I came out of the toilets, I sort of went round the corner, washed my hands, went round the corner, and there's just a wall at the end of here. So I just made a complete idiot of myself and just turned round and went back again and found my way out through this maze of toilet walls. I suppose really and truly I'm a bit sort of off the topic here, because I don't know what a coping strategy for that could be.
Well, funny enough, what I do in that same situation, and I'm conscious I do it because, again, because I took because yesterday I took my lad out to a restaurant just in Broadstairs up at our local shopping centre just for lunch. And no, I didn't. A couple of days ago. Anyway, it doesn't matter what day it was. It was a couple of days ago. And again, I haven't been in the restaurant for so long because of COVID and everything. I thought, oh God, where are the loos? And it's something I always do now. And I realised I do it is we'll get taken to our seat by the waiter, sit down, and then I'll look around and I'll scan the room, like the large room that we're in, and I'll work out where the bar is. Bizarrely, I don't drink. Where the bar is, where the waiters are congregating. So if I need to call a waiter if there's a problem, where the loos are, where the entrance and exit is compared to where we came in from. And I'll spend two or three minutes just looking around and figuring things out and just looking at the tables and the chairs and how busy it is in between. So I can think, right, okay, when I go, I'm going to have to think about this or that. And then I start building up to going to the loo, or I start building up, going up to pay the bill or whatever. I'm thinking, right, okay, I'm going to go and do that now. I'm going to get up. I'm going to walk that way. Then walk left, and then I'm going to stop there, and then I'm going to check where I'm going, and then carry on, or whatever it is. And I realise that I do that every time, and I'm constantly looking where things are and where people are.
Actually, that's something that I tend to do on quite a general basis, and that is, I have to have, if I'm cooking or if I'm doing something, I have to have everything I need ready. So to be really prepared in advance. And that sort of falls into a similar category, I think. You know, you're just planning for almost any eventuality.
Yeah.
So it's all in the planning and the preparation, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like cooking in particular. I have to get everything. I can't, you know, I marvel at watching people when they just... Right, okay, we'll get a pan from here. Right, we'll put that on and put some stuff in it. And then I'll get some of this out of the cupboard. I couldn't do that to save my life. I have to have, right, what do I need for this? Right, I need to prepare all the vegetables. So they're all prepared. And I'm going to need a sieve, so I'll get the sieve out. Yeah, I even get plate, knife and fork. Yeah, everything I need to prepare, cook, serve the meal. That's the only way I can do it. And... So, and also that reminds me, I mean, it's nothing to do with cooking, but when I was at school, there was only one teacher I can remember who picked up on something that is clearly a dyspraxia trait. And that is, it was a needlework teacher, actually. Sadly, she was standing in for my regular teacher because she picked up on it. She said, "You seem to have a problem getting started, but when you've got everything you need, you're fine then, aren't you?" You know, and I never really thought too much of it, but that's very, very obviously a dyspraxia trait because, you know, I do still do that. You know, I can't, you know, I sort of go into not panic mode. I mean, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but I can't function properly with a task unless I've got everything I need in front of me and it's easily accessible.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. Yeah, yeah. And it can stress you out. It stresses me out if I'm not just ready. If for some reason I've got to try and do two different things at once, I can feel my stress and anxiety levels really picking up. Yeah. Really picking up. And it is tough. So breaking it down into those small components does really make it so much easier. But of course, in the fast-paced world we live in, that's not always easy to do.
No.
Sadly, I mean, I'm not suggesting there's a particularly easy way of changing that. Mind you, though, this COVID experience, when the world has slowed because of lockdowns and so on, it helped a hell of a lot.
Definitely,
it really has.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't wish for a return to continual lockdowns by any stretch of imagination, but it has been nice to go, let's just take a backward step for a minute and just plan carefully. Let's go out when we need to. Let's just be a bit more careful, a bit more thoughtful, and it's appealed to my sense of dyspraxia, something chronic.
Yes,
it really has.
I agree with you totally, and I think also having meetings and whether it's social or whether it's work related or whatever online means it takes away an awful lot of the pressure of right now. I've got to find out how to get there. I've got to make sure I know the route and all that stuff that I always do by having a good old look at Google Earth to have a look at the route first, and look for landmarks and stuff, because it's a nightmare. It takes military precision planning, I think, to go somewhere. So it reduces that level of anxiety, certainly.
Oh, definitely. So I can always remember when I used to work, I don't work full time kind of now because I'm a single parent and all that kind of stuff. So it doesn't work for me at the moment. I sort of do bits and pieces and part time. But when I was full time, especially working for local authorities, I'd be travelling all over the place to meetings, to conferences, and I'd be up and down Kent, and I travelled all sorts of northeast, northwest parts of the Jurassic Coast for training, delivering training, all this. And it was so, I look back and I think, God, my anxiety levels and my stress at having to plan all that and going unusual places and all these things that we've covered in this podcast, it was considered normal that you had to physically go there. And I can always remember being, when I was younger, being very anti working from home. I always thought, no, it should be in the office, should go into the office. My opinion's completely changed now, and I can finally see, it took me this to have my eyes opened, I think, but I can finally see what people were talking about when they say, let's work from home, let's be a bit more productive, let's think about things in a different way, let's use the technology we've got to help us, and I don't know if I'd ever want to go back to full-time office work. I wouldn't, because there's so many opportunities to. But why would I want to travel all the way to Dorset to do a training course? You'd have to stay overnight, okay, it's a bit of a jolly sometimes if you go with people you get on with, and going out for a nice meal and everything like that. But the actual planning and the logistics of it is so hard. You think, God, just set me up on a Zoom call or a Teams call or Skype or whatever it is. And we'll spend the day together virtually. Let's do it like that. I couldn't imagine going back to that way of work now.
I definitely couldn't. And I'm very glad to be mostly retired. I just work 4 hours a week for the co-op as a member pioneer, which is, that's almost the other way around in many ways, because I was grounded because I'm over 60. So the co-op wouldn't let me go out, during lockdown and semi-lockdown, that we've had fairly recently, and for my own good, really. But now I'm allowed out again, and I'm just itching.
Oh, fantastic.
And meet people and do things. But because it's only 4 hours a week, it's nowhere near as stressful as working full-time. I don't think I could go back to that now.
No. That's going to be an interesting tell for me. I'm quite unquote only 40, in 5 years time, 10 years time, when my son's 15, 20 and he's saying, I don't know, what the hell are you doing, Dad, still picking me up from school? Clear off, I'll go with my mates, stuff like that. And I've got this extra time on my hand. To the thought of kind of working at one job full time is, That's a big change in my thinking to where I was even 5 years ago, pre-child and pre-pandemic. It's changed my mindset, and so the coping strategies I'd need for that change of mindset, I think, are going to be new, and I'll have to learn some new types of strategies depending on what kind of career I have in the future. I don't know what they are yet, because I don't know what the future is going to look like.
No, quite.
My career for the next, potentially I've got another, 25, 26, 27 odd years left of my working life before I can draw my state pension for what good it will be. What will that look like? I don't honestly know, to tell you the truth.
Massively unknown. Don't you think that having coping strategies strategies,
strategies.
Coping strategies is it's to help us to cope with a situation, obviously, that we find difficult as dyspraxics. But even the coping strategy itself can be extremely tiring. So I guess in that respect, it's a double-edged sword.
Oh, Barbara.
Oh, God. On that, I think anyone who wants to know what that's all about, just go back to some of our earlier podcasts. There is an explanation in one of them why that makes us laugh. So on that happy note.
Yeah.
Happy mental note. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from her.
Bye.
Bye.